Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Sophie Haydock about her debut historical novel, The Flames. Sophie is an award-winning writer and journalist living in East London. She also works as a digital editor for the Sunday Times Audible Short Story Award and is Associate Director of The Word Factory. In this episode, we discuss Flipping the Canvas, where the artist's muses take centre stage, listening and observing people to create the details of side characters, and the key to staying positive on days of doubt. But first, here's Sophie with an extract from The Flames.
Then Edith experiences the tipping point, a moment of balance before the descent, the sensation manifesting itself first in her belly. She puts her hand to her stomach, desperate, scared that somehow the baby is in danger, that it is all her fault. Why is she being so reckless? She remembers, then, that she has been pushed to the edge by the people she loves most. It takes less than half an hour for the wheel to complete its circuit. In that time, she has thought of death and love, of blood and betrayal, and where her loyalties lie. Who can we trust in this world? Edith still hasn't a clue. She begins walking again. Where else can she go? She feels as if she were a homeless rambler, one of these unfortunate types who have frittered everything away and must wander the streets with no chance of redemption or return. She is sure she's mistaken for such a figure too, grubby as she has become, shivering and shaking. She warms her belly, thinking only of the baby, of its emerging limbs and eyes closed against the darkness inside her. Edith approaches the market. Stalls are closing up for the evening, men and boys packing away the produce, piling up crates. She runs her hands over wrinkled fruit and meagre vegetables, the prices sky high. One for a pretty girl down on her luck, a man says, putting his hand beneath his stall and pulling out an orange. He holds it out and she is transfixed. Edith sits down. He produces a knife to peel it. She's so empty and the juice is so sweet. It's rare. As she is leaving, she touches a stack of tall, brittle firewood, the only type that can be sourced during this sad war, and imagines the flames that will consume it, given time. They promise so much, life-giving warmth and destruction. A line that is so terribly fine.
Hi, Sophie. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to talking about the flames with you.
Hi, Chloe. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Can you start by giving us a brief outline of the plot of your novel?
So for anybody who's ever heard of the artist Egon Schiele, he was a very controversial, charismatic young artist who created fantastic, provocative works of art back in Vienna more than 100 years ago. I first got to know Egon Schiele when I was a student and was really seduced by his fantastic artworks. And the The Flames is really about the four women who were most influential in his life. So we have Adele Harms, who is one of the sisters who gets to know the young artist when he moves into an apartment across the street from them in Vienna. She is the sister of Edith Harms. And between them, these two young women kind of vie for the artist's attention. There is also Gertrude Sheila, who is the artist's little sister, and she poses for her brother in the nude, which is a detail that really sparked my imagination. And then there is Vali Nertzl, who is a young woman who Sheila is rumoured to have met in the studio of Gustav Klimt. So there are these four women, all of whom modelled for Sheila, and all of whom had really different lives and very dynamic overlapping stories. So I really wanted to find a way to give each of them the opportunity to tell those stories. And I think the result is The Flames.
And they really do have such incredible stories, each of these women. When I was reading your author's note, I got the impression that your inspiration for The Flames is almost a bit like a puzzle, all these kind of pieces coming together. So can you speak a bit about how that inspiration began? And what it was that inspired you with these, that made you want to write about these women in particular?
Yeah, so I'm really lucky because I know the exact date that the idea for this novel came into my life. It was the 10th of January and it was 2015, which sounds like an incredibly long time ago, but you know very well how slow the world of publishing works. So I was at the Courtauld Gallery at Somerset House and I'd been invited to an exhibition by my friend who was visiting from London. Visiting London from her home in Yorkshire that weekend. And she invited me along to the show. I think it was the final weekend, the last opportunity to see this incredible exhibition. And I really almost didn't go. And I'm so, so glad that I did, because as soon as I walked into the exhibition space, I was really taken with these incredible portraits that I saw all around me. And I realized that the women who I was looking at, and as an aside, the exhibition was called The Radical Nude. So that gives you some hint of, you know, the position that these women were in. It was indeed very radical and the artworks were very provocative. And I realized straight away that these women were seen very explicitly, but their stories had never been heard. And, you know, I was looking into the frames, I was looking into their eyes and wondering what their relationship was with the artist, what their relationship was with each other, the jealousies that might have existed between them, the ways that their lives overlapped. And it was in the exhibition space that day that I first discovered the name Edith Harms. I realized that she was the artist's wife. And I discovered a really tragic detail about her life. I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it was very sad the way that her life ended. And initially I thought maybe I'd tell a story about Egon Schiele through her eyes, and that we'd get to know her and see these details about his life in this way. And it was only when I went home and did some research that I discovered she had a sister who was incredibly dynamic and strong-willed and interesting. And then, of course, I discovered the other two women, and I just felt like there was this lovely structure that was emerging for me. So actually, it feels like it happened very quickly and almost like a kind of, it felt for me like a thunderbolt moment in the gallery. It just straight away, I knew that I had this idea and that I could potentially develop it. And I think within a matter of weeks, I had the structure, I had the storyline, I knew where the kind of plot points were going to be. So really, looking back, it happened very, very quickly. And I guess the slow part was, you know, not just writing it, but working out how to be an author, what time of day you work best, and, you know, how many words even is a novel meant to be. I certainly didn't know then that a kind of average novel was about 80,000 words. I didn't know how to get an agent. That was a complete mystery. I knew nothing about the publishing process, which I got a publishing deal 2 years before my book actually came out. So, you know, that's a huge amount of time, you know, when you think about the evolution of this of this novel. So it's really interesting. But I think for me that the idea came very quickly and almost kind of fully formed.
That's so interesting. I was wondering whether you mentioned that there were such little kind of snapshots about their life when you were in the gallery. So did you have an impression that when you started to write, there wasn't going to be much background? Or did you feel like, okay, I'm going to start writing this book, I'll do my research, and maybe I'll discover more about their lives? Did you kind of, were you disappointed that there wasn't much information out there, or was that almost liberating that you had the canvas, as it were, to write their story instead?
Absolutely that. So I think there was sufficient biographical information about each of the women. I knew their names, which was a massive bonus, because for lots of women who are painted throughout history, their names are not known or they're anonymous. So it was wonderful to have their names. It was wonderful to have the bones of their stories, how they lived, their family situation, you know, details like this that really gave me a kind of outline of their lives and who they might have been. But I think really it was the artwork that gave me the most information about their personalities, and not only how they were captured by Egon Schiele. And he is or was an expressionist artist, which means that he really tried to reveal the inner workings of a sitter. He wanted not just to paint them as they were, but to really capture elements of their personality and their character. And I think he's done this incredibly well in all his artworks of the women that I wrote about. So I saw them through his eyes. And I also, the more I looked at these paintings and drawings, I also really could pick up so much of their personality, how they presented themselves, how they revealed themselves. You know, often they're completely naked, and whether they look comfortable with that, whether they're smirking or smiling or turning their face away, or, you know, all these details gave me so much information about their character. And once I had those, I could kind of then slot them into the aspects of their relationships with each other. So I realized that a portrait I'd been looking at for a long time since I was a student, I had it kind of a postcard of it taped to my wall at university. And I'd looked at this woman probably every day for the best part of a year, and I'd never questioned who she was to Egon Schiele. And it was only a decade later that I realized that she was the artist's sister-in-law. You know, she's there, she's posing in her stockings. She's got this incredibly intense, seductive look on her face. And I think when you realize that there's this dynamic between the artist and the sitter, that is one perhaps that you wouldn't have imagined, or that you can make assumptions that there would be some tensions there. You know, I wanted to know how Egon's wife, Edith, felt about her sister posing for her husband in this way. You know, these things aren't neutral, and I think it was really interesting for me to be able to pick apart the aspects of these women's relationships and where the jealousies might have been, and, you know, where they might have betrayed themselves and each other.
Because that rivalry is such a central part of particularly the first section of the book, and I think the one nearer the end when we're with Edith. So to know that you have kind of invented that rivalry is incredible, really, because there are the way you kind of write, I guess, the facts of their life, and you weave them into the things that you've invented yourself. It's completely seamless. Like, there's no way anyone, unless they knew the individuals, would be able to pick apart what is your invention and what is actually historical fact. So I think you achieved that incredibly well.
That's really nice to hear. And I feel like it's not such a gigantic leap. You know, I feel like I've definitely taken a creative license and I've made up this element of the dynamic between the two sisters and injected rivalry into their story. But just from the facts of how society would have been then, that Adele was the older sister, she would have had an expectation that she would marry first. Edith, as the younger sister, was certainly very shy and uncomfortable in the portraits the artist made of her. So even though I've taken this creative leap, I definitely think that I kind of feel reassured and confident and comfortable in the leaps that I have made, because I feel that they're grounded in what could have been possible. So also Adele, as an older woman, she said in an interview with Alessandra Cimini that she had had an affair with Sheila. And, you know, this could be misinterpreted, mistranslated. It could mean that she'd, you know, had an encounter with him, or that she'd been courted by him, or it could mean that she physically slept with her sister's husband. You know, there's so many nuances there, and there's so many questions that are sparked from these details. So I don't feel like I've done the women any disservice by taking these imaginative leaps, and I hope that I've kept as close to the story as is possible, whilst also hopefully, you know, creating a dynamic plot.
You mentioned that when you were kind of writing these women, they all have very different lives. Obviously, they all have a relationship with Egon. They're all his subjects in terms of his art. How did you find kind of writing these four distinctive voices? Is that something that came easily to you, or did you find that kind of just through their sheer personality, you were able to approach their voices in a very different way?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think, looking back, that they were all instantly their own character. Their voices were just incredibly clear to me, almost as if I was interviewing them. I'm a journalist, I'm a trained journalist, so I've spent a lot of my career tracking down people with unusual stories and interviewing them, and then putting their words into kind of first person pieces. So absorbing what they say and kind of regurgitating it in a way that makes it an interesting story. So in a way, I felt like I had the ability to do that with these characters. I listened to what they were saying, and I tried to see things from their perspectives. And then I kind of took those voices and tried to be as true to how I felt they were communicating those things as possible. So they all straight away just had these really clear ways of presenting themselves. And it was a really interesting process to kind of channel that in a way.
When I was reading it, one of the things that struck me was that as much as it's a story of exploitation, it's also about kind of different forms of love. But there's a line in it where Gertie promises that she's never going to fall in love because she sees it as losing part of herself or killing the best parts of herself, I think she says. But there's never a point in the novel where Egon overshadows them. They're very much the focus of the novel. So why was it important to you to keep the focus on these four women instead of naturally kind of writing about Egon's career and his art?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I think deliberately that for me, Egon was a shadowy character. I wanted to keep him in the shadows, and I wanted him to be somebody who changed in different lights, who you got a different perspective on each time. You know, sometimes I think as readers, we feel quite sympathetic towards him. Other times we completely despise him and are really, just annoyed by his behaviour and perhaps disgusted by his behaviour. And I think that's, for me, was an important part of his character development, is that he's never just one thing. And when it came to the women, I realised that really their sides of the story had never been told before. So there are a couple of books about Egon Schiele, which are fantastic and do a really good job of telling the story of his life, other historical fiction. But I always felt that there hadn't been one that really shone a light on the muses and their emotional connections in this way. And I felt that in a way I wanted to give them the opportunity to flip the canvas, so to speak. So they almost got the chance to paint a portrait of the artist for the first time. So instead of him painting all these very explicit and erotic and sensual paintings of them, you know, depicted in ways that they perhaps didn't have much say over, they got to paint a portrait of the artist from their perspective. And in doing so, I hope that, you know, he becomes, if not a particularly sympathetic character, I hope he is still a compelling one, just because I think he was very troubled, but I think he was also very talented.
You're right, we do see kind of different sides of him through these narratives. One thing I really loved about your writing, which I thought was so skillful, was your characterization. Even obviously the focus for most parts of the novel are your four women, but the even the kind of side characters, which we meet briefly, are really, their kind of personality is told in a very concise way, which I loved. And I have to read out this quote because it just summed up your skill at this. So Adele and Edith's mother is very judgmental when it comes to meeting suitors. And this quote, it says, "For Mutti, it makes a reality that much harder to swallow. She cannot legitimately point out this suitor's flaws until she has made his acquaintance, identified them all, and thrown in a few more for good measure." And that's at the point where she's unable to meet a suitor, and she's disappointed because that she can't point out his flaws. I just absolutely love that line because it tells you so much about her. How did you approach the characterization of these kind of more minor characters to really make them feel real? And then obviously, these characters, perhaps you didn't even have any reference points for.
Yeah, that's right. So again, it's really interesting because it's hard to kind of look back and almost pick apart why or how you did something with a character. It all just feels like it evolves quite naturally. But I guess really for observations like that, the line that you've just read out to really connect with people, I guess there has to be some element of truth in them. So people recognize something that they might at times have thought or that they, you know, and I think you almost have to listen very closely as an author to your own thoughts, perhaps even the ones that are a bit more subconscious or unsavory. Sometimes you really have to think, oh, I'm thinking that really judgmental thing about someone. That'd be great for a character. And you know, you also have to really people watch and people listen, and you're almost collecting these little snippets and putting them in a jar so that you can use them for later. And I'm sure you do it, and I'm sure lots of other authors do it. You know, you're constantly looking for these really specific details that you notice in yourself or others that you think, well, if I'm thinking this, then other people are going to think in the same way. And it, you know, I think at that moment, you know, that people hopefully are going to connect with lines like that. But yeah, thank you.
So you've mentioned already that there's a perspective in the novel, which is kind of a more modern perspective. So it's the late 60s where we meet an older Adele. And there's a moment where she's in a gallery and she says she's fed up, or she asked why she has to keep listening to men telling her how things were in the past. And your novel really does feel like a kind of conscious decision to amplify the female subjects and also the female perspective in terms of art. Was that you kind of answering back to a kind of, I guess, a very male skewed perspective of the art world and kind of art history?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think consciously and subconsciously I wanted to subvert the male gaze, which obviously women, and these women in particular, have been subjected to for more than a century. I wanted to reclaim that narrative and really give these, you know, silenced muses the opportunity to tell their sides of the story. And I think so much of history is presented to us from this male gaze and from the male mouth. And it's really important that, you know, these steps are taken to really reclaim as much as we can and just give these women the opportunity to share a side of the story that hasn't been heard before.
Mm-hmm. So your structure is quite interesting because it's in individual sections, but each woman's story does overlap. They kind of meet each other or they have interactions. And as an element to some of them where, because you're only getting one side of the story, you don't find out the other side until much later on in the book. There's an event in the first section of the book, which kind of confounds the reader and Adele. And it's not until you reach near the end of the book that you see why certain things have happened. So when did you decide to, obviously you've mentioned already that you were originally going to write it just from Edith's perspective. When did you mm-hmm. decide to open it up and tell it from all of their perspectives, and kind of how did you go about structuring the novel in a way that overlaps all the stories?
Yeah, I think my first instinct to tell the story of Egon Schiele through his wife's perspective was probably a sensible one. Mm-hmm. It would have been much simpler and a much less demanding exercise. Unfortunately, I just read a wonderful book in the days before I went to the exhibition called Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi Wood. And it's a novel about the lives of the four wives of Ernest Hemingway, done in a structure that tells you a little bit about this fantastic writer, controversial writer, in a way as seen through these women who were all very different. And I think perhaps if I hadn't read Mrs. Hemingway at that very crucial point in the evolution of this novel, then I might not have thought about structuring the novel in this way. So it was probably, I think it's been a great challenge to have four voices and to have them overlapping. It felt a bit like a jigsaw puzzle at times. Some of the feedback that I get on the novel, which has surprised me, is that, oh, it's an ambitious novel. It's because it probably was overly arrogant to think that I could do that, or overly ambitious to even attempt to weave all that together. And I'm sure it added at least a year or two onto the writing process, just because you go and unpick something and you have to unravel it somewhere else, and then you suddenly realize that person doesn't know that so-and-so, you know, and you tie yourself in knots. So I think that whilst it was a lovely challenge and something that I don't regret, it was something that perhaps was complicated things. And with book two, I know we're going to talk about book two later, but I did try again just to tell one story from one woman, and I just couldn't do it. You know, I just felt like you really needed these multiple perspectives in order to get enough energy and to get enough dynamics going between the characters. So again, I've just don't know if it's my thing or what, with the way that I think or the way that I write, but I find that I really need these multiple perspectives in order to keep everything going.
I wonder if it's kind of subconsciously a way to keep yourself interested and excited by the writing. I know when I started writing my second novel, I kept thinking, right, I'm going to make this easier, I'm going to make the structure easier or the story easier. It never works like that.
Oh no, your brain's like, oh yeah, this is easy, and then it's like, this is boring.
Yeah,
you know? Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Definitely.
So what made you decide to include the prologue and the interludes from the 1960s when Adele is an older woman? Was that something that came later in the writing process?
That is something, as I recall now, that came during the research process. So quite quickly, I think back in 2015, I did go to Vienna as part of my research trip and, you know, my initial trying to work out how this novel was going to come together. And I spoke to a really wonderful Sheila scholar, Christian Bauer, and I was quizzing him a little bit about Adele and the other models. And I asked him, you know, I couldn't find in any of the books anything about what had happened to Adele later in life. I knew that she didn't die young. I knew that she lived to be older, just because I'd read interviews that she'd done with Alessandra Cimini as an older woman. And he told me that Adele had died when she was 78, that she'd been penniless, she had no family, she had no children, and that she'd been practically living on the streets of Vienna when she died. And this detail for me just sparked so many questions, because you look at these beautiful paintings that Egon Schiele made of Adele Harms, and she has the whole world at her feet. I mean, she's beautiful, she's educated, she comes from a good family. You know, she could have had her pick of men, I have no doubt about it. And yet, 50 years later, she ended up with absolutely nothing. And I think I'm really fascinated by these slippage points in time when people's lives shift, you know, where they go from having an expectation that things are going to be a certain way, and there's no reason why that would ever be any other way. And then a decade later, they're completely different people, and they could never have envisioned how those chain of events would kind of unfurl. And Adele for me really encapsulated this kind of way of thinking. And I wanted to find the point at which her life had slipped out of control. And I wanted to kind of chart the way in which she tried to find redemption as an older woman in the final days of her life, and how I was really interested really in how she might have carried perhaps guilt around, or her own grief at the death of her sister and the man that I suppose that she was in love with. And so straight away, the opening scene where she's knocked down by a younger woman, you know, cycling through this district of Vienna, where Adele as a young woman had first encountered the artist, that was always the opening scene. That was just this really strong image I had in my head of who Adele would have been at this kind of later stage in her life. And from that, this just relationship kind of developed between the older woman and the younger woman. And I thought it was really important in lots of ways to have this setting in the 1960s, Just to give Sheila a little bit of historical context, there were so many great shifts that were happening in the 60s anyway for women, so many more freedoms, that I thought it would be interesting to look back on him from Ava's perspective, and to be able to put a little bit about who he was in context, so that it was had a little bit more depth. So I think that's why that kind of structure emerged there. And then, without realizing it, and it was only when I started working with my editor that she pointed out that in fact there were these kind of four frames, and you very much got you know, four women in their frames, and then the sections in the gallery between Adele and Eva were the kind of interludes in which we got a little bit more perspective. So that's how that emerged.
Mm. And I think those sections as well, like you say, they give them the context. They also show that these artworks and Egon Schiele have endured time. You know, they've been significant in the art world. It hasn't just been the kind of that short period that you cover in those women's lives with him. It's gone on and on. So yeah, I definitely think it was an interesting kind of addition to the story.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you liked it. I felt like it was important, but you know, I never know how people are going to respond to that.
I just wanted to talk about your writing career, really, because you've got you're the associate director of the Word Factory, which is a literary organization which people might be aware of, and you also won the Empress Prize for New Writers, Empress Prize, and you've also had an amazing journalism career. So are you able to speak about your kind of your journey into writing fiction and how that led you onto getting an agent and a book deal? I know you said you were kind of naive or kind of you had no idea how to get one, so maybe you could speak about how that came about.
Yeah, I think again the beauty of being published, I don't know if you find the same thing, but you almost get to look back on the last decade of your career or your life, and you get to join the dots in a new way. So you get to say, oh yeah, well, I was gravitating, of course I went into journalism because I was gravitating towards writing, and of course I didn't get that job because I was meant to, you know, invest more time in, you know, working on my novel. So I've definitely had lots of that in the last few months. I've been given the opportunity to rewrite a little bit about my life and my story, which has been a really strange process. I don't know if that's something that other debut authors have experienced. But looking back now, I can see that I always kind of gravitated towards very personal, first person stories. I always wanted to speak to people who something unusual had happened to them. And I'd kind of track them down and I'd convince them to talk to me. And then I'd ask all these really, you know, very personal questions about some of the most challenging experiences of their lives. And as I mentioned earlier, I'd then kind of regurgitate that in a way, and I'd write it up in the first person. So literally kind of putting myself through this experience in order to tell it in the most kind of compelling way. And that really felt like much of what I did with historical fiction. I'm in awe of anybody who sits down to write a novel and doesn't have a ready-made plot and doesn't have all these characters with their weird quirks and, you know, even the names. I could never have made up names that were as perfect for these women as the ones that they already had, you know. And I just think I'm really, people say to me, oh, you've done so much research, it's really impressive, I could never do what you do. But I could really never do what, you know, other authors do, which is just create all of this wonderful stuff in their mind. I think I'd fall at the first hurdle. So all my experience in journalism definitely set me up for writing historical fiction and biographical fiction, where you're taking real people's lives and you're kind of reimagining how they would have felt and how they would have lived. And yes, you mentioned the Empress Prize, which was an incredible privilege to win that. I never expected to get into that position, but again, it was a massive boost at a stage in my writing career when I had no idea if what I was doing was, if I was on the right track, if I was any good, if I had any potential. And I think at that moment, there's just this kind of tiny little voice in your head saying, oh, okay, somebody has really enjoyed this and somebody has seen the potential and you should totally keep going. So that felt wonderful. And it was at that point that I had interest from really incredible agents, and I did more work on the manuscript because it wasn't finished at that point. And I worked with people who do editorial reports, Sally OJ, who is wonderful. She gave me some fantastic feedback. And that was all before I queried my dream agent, who is Juliette Mushins. And I kind of pulled together the package, you know, as well as I could. I polished it all 1,000 times and I checked, you know, my submission letter and my first 3 chapters. And, you know, it was when she said yes straight away within, you know, a matter of hours that I kind of, you know, really started to feel quite scared, because I was like, oh, wow, you know, this is going somewhere that I didn't anticipate. You know, and I think you have all the hope that something would unfurl this way. But I don't know if I ever felt that way with my journalism career. It never flowed, or it never kind of progressed in such a kind of meaningful and kind of easy way. It sounds like a weird word to use, but I always just felt like I was on a little bit of a, you know, a nice slide with the book stuff. Everybody always seemed to enjoy it and like it and want it. And it just went from strength to strength. And I was always so grateful to be part of that and in the middle of that, because you can't, you know, all debut authors know, all authors know that that's something that you can't control, how people are going to respond to your work. So yeah, when I got Juliette as my agent, I was completely delighted. She put it out on submission, I think after a couple of months. We did a little bit of work together, and that's when it got picked up by Doubleday, who again are complete dream publishers. So I feel like I've had a really nice experience of publishing. There's definitely been lots of lows along the way. There has been rejections, there has been self-doubt, there has been complete U-turns when you realize that you've backed yourself into a cul-de-sac and you really want to get out. So it's not been completely plain sailing, but I think all of that just adds to your experience as a debut, somebody who's both incredibly grateful to be in this position and incredibly grateful to be telling these kind of stories. And yeah, it all just gets you to a place where, you know, you can look back and think it's such a privilege to be in this position.
So I wondered whether you could share your top 3 tips for other writers or aspiring writers.
Yes, I can. So I think it was Sylvia Plath who said, I love my rejection slips. They show me I try. And my number one tip would be embrace rejection, because I don't think you can get anywhere as a writer until you absolutely embrace rejection. And for me, that meant I remember, you know, entering a few competitions, first chapter, opening chapter competitions, I think I entered one. I didn't get anywhere. I really wanted to win. It was my dream competition to win. I didn't get anywhere. Felt terrible, didn't write for 2 months, you know, this kind of really skewed way of thinking when I was right back at the beginning of my writing, you know, process. And I remember reading or hearing about this wonderful concept, which was aim for 100 rejections. And this really like spoke to me. So I thought, right, next year I'm going to enter everything. I'm going to enter all the first chapter competitions I can find. I'm going to, you know, build up a list of 100 agents and, you know, work my way through them. I'm really going to keep a folder of the rejections and kind of feel proud when I get another one, because it shows me I try. And it was off the back of that that I entered, I think, about almost a dozen first chapter competitions. And straight away I got you know, longlisted for six, shortlisted for four, and I ended up winning the Impress Prize. I would never have entered the Impress Prize if I hadn't been taking on this attitude, because I probably just wouldn't have, you know, it might have slipped my mind, or, oh, you know, and I just think that was something that for me really changed my career, changed my attitude, and really I made connections throughout that entire process, which I still, you know, have friendships with people who were judges. Rebecca F. John, for example, we're going to be appearing, she was a judge for one of the short first chapter competitions, and we'll be appearing at Hay Together in the summer. You know, so just these connections that you make by changing your attitude a little bit, I think can have such a positive impact on everything.
Right.
And did you want two more?
Yeah, oh gosh, two more. Great. So,
the next one would be to trust your own journey as an author. I think we are all guilty of compare and contrast, and we're all looking at what everybody else gets. And, you know, it doesn't matter what anybody, you know, what you've got, it's always what the person ahead of you, oh, you know, but so and so got spreadges, and you know, it's all these kind of things that if
everyone social wants media spreadges.
Everybody wants a spread, absolutely. And you know, these are beautiful things, and they're all these great extras, but they're the cherry on the cake of publication, which is just such a wonderful goal in itself. So I would really say that if you can trust your own journey, trust that it won't be like anybody else's, and just try as hard as you can through whatever method works best for you, not to get kind of caught in that churn of comparison, because it really does do so much damage. And I just think you know, we're all on very different paths as debuts, and at the end of the day, you're always going to get somebody who your book is going to be their favorite book, and it's going to speak to people, and it's going to be on the shelves. And I just think we're incredibly lucky. And I think it was, this kind of moves on to my third point, it was Anne Lamotte who said, when you look back at the end of your life, I think you're going to pinch yourself that you got to be one of the people who did it. And for me, this is my third point, which is enjoy it. You know, like, publishing a book is a beautiful thing. It's such a joy. if you can hold on to the kind of good elements and not get completely lost in the rabbit hole, I think, you know, you get to be incredibly proud of what you've achieved, the hours of investment of your time that you've put into something that you didn't know whether it would pay off or not. And I think the fact that it did pay off, and that we've all come as far as we've come as debuts, is just something that we should all really embrace. And I try and remind myself that publishing a book is not a process by which I want to be made happy, but mm-hmm. it's a process by which I want to expand my potential and expand my horizons. And so if ever I do feel a bit sad one day because something's caught me out, I just think, no, you know, like I'm totally, my horizons are broadening. And that's, for me, was the kind of goal of getting into this position in the first place.
Mm. I'm going to get that printed on a t-shirt. I think that's great.
Get me one as well, please.
Yeah. So can you think of some comparison novels? We always do this in publishing. When you're pitching your book, you have to give your kind of comp titles. So can you think of some that would kind of fit well with The Flames?
Well, yes, I think I've already mentioned Mrs. Hemingway by Naomi Wood, which I would highly recommend. It's about the four wives of Ernest Hemingway. One of the books that inspired me to write The Flames that I read when I was a teenager was Girl with a Pearl Earring by Tracy Chevalier. I never dreamed when I read that book that I'd be doing something similar, you know, looking at a portrait, looking at the work of an artist and retelling the story. But I think that teenage me would have been so proud and impressed that I'd taken that step. I really love Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. I wish I could be anywhere near as talented as she is. But I think what she did with that book, you know, taking the very emotional story of Shakespeare's son and how that impacted the family was just so brave and so well executed. And another book that really had a huge impact on me when I was younger was called I Was Amelia Earhart by Jane Mendelsohn. And that's a book about the American aviator, Amelia Earhart, whose plane disappeared while she was circumnavigating the globe. And it was a reimagining of what happened to her in the days following the plane crash. And I think it was at that point that I realized that you were allowed to take the stories of real life people and reimagine them. And that's something that I carried with me into my career as a writer. So I feel very inspired by that novel as well.
But can you give us briefly a little hint about what you're writing next?
Yeah, so my little hint is I'm pretty much same but different. So it's another artist. It's the women in his life who fueled his creativity, fueled his greatness. It's set in a different country, so we're not in Austria anymore, but we're still in Europe. And it's the same time period, but we get to move through time a little bit further, just because he lived to be a much older man than Egon Schiele, who died so tragically young. So it's been interesting getting to know other women and another artist in the same way. One who I don't think is as charismatic as Egon Schiele or as controversial, but the story is just as compelling, and I think there's elements to the women's lives that are just absolutely fascinating, and their side of the story has never been told before, which I'm gobsmacked about. So I feel really lucky that I get to be the person to bring this to the fore.
Well, I'm really excited to see what you write next, Sophie, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chloe. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I love your work, I love your book, I love your podcast.
Thank you. That was Sophie Haydock talking about her debut historical novel, The Flames, which is out now and available to buy. Before I go, let me just tell you about two events I've got coming up where I'm hosting this podcast, Confessions of a Debut Novelist, live. First, I'm going to be talking to three authors at the Being a Writer Festival, hosted by the Literary Consultancy, on June the 28th. Then on July the 22nd, I'm going to be talking to Louise Morrish about her historical novel at Jericho Writers Summer Festival. Both of these events are virtual, so you can join anywhere in the world and even ask questions. And if you're interested in hearing me talk in person about my novel, The Sea Women, I'll be at the Margate Bookie on Thursday the 2nd of June. Tickets for all these events are available to buy, and I'll put all the details in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.